This podcast was brought to you by withaim.co.
Welcome back to Vanishing Shadows. In the last episode,
I think about my own escape plan, how difficult it will be to execute now. I'll need Benjamin to let me out of his self-styled dungeon. I'll need to earn back his trust so he'll give me the space I need to get away, to fake my death. Only one thought gives me comfort. One way or another, I will soon be free. The weekend passes in a blur. I only know the day by my husband's presence. He hasn't returned to the office, so it must be Saturday or Sunday. Eventually, I realize that he's not going back. He's working in his study because I can't be left alone. Even with Jesse out of the picture, Benjamin no longer trusts me, for obvious reasons. I had plotted his murder to take everything he's built for my own. Is he slightly afraid of me now? It's an uplifting, even giddy feeling. But I play the penitent, ask my husband for forgiveness. I tell him I was manipulated by Jesse, bullied into his scheme, which is not entirely false. Eventually, Benjamin buys it. Of course he does. He thinks I am weak and stupid, incapable of power or agency. He doesn't suspect that my remorse is just a ploy to get out of the basement room, because I can't enact my plan if I am shut away as a prisoner. And so, when my husband lets me out, I revert to my former role. I cook his meals, clean his house, take his punishments, all with a knowing glint in my eye. As the days pass, his unease is still palpable. He has not returned to his downtown office and remains locked away in his study for hours on end. He has stationed Nate inside, the big man standing near the front door, eyes subtly following me around the house. I am a lab rat trapped in a cage, studied, monitored, ultimately disposable. One morning, after I set Benjamin's eggs in front of him, I tender a request. May I go see my mother today?
No.
It's the answer I expected, so I don't respond, don't press. I had hoped to say goodbye to her. But in a way, I already did, long ago. She won't know I am gone, so she won't miss me. I have made my peace with it. But as I'm cleaning the kitchen, I notice Nate chatting to my husband, their heads bent in serious conversation. Moments later, Benjamin approaches me.
If you want to spend your time with a zombie, go ahead, he says, but Nate will drive you.
Thank you. My smile appears grateful. From the back seat of Nate's SUV, I watch the city fly past. This will be my last sojourn into Seattle, a place I have always considered my home. Now it feels like a foreign country. My world has dwindled to such a tiny radius, gym, grocery store, state park, that venturing outside of my orbit is strange and new. Thanks, I say to Nate, who has yet to speak. His eyes meet mine in the mirror. They are questioning. For convincing Benjamin to let me visit my mom.
You can't keep a person from their mother,
he says, flicking on his indicator.
That's just wrong.
But everything about my relationship with Benjamin is wrong, and Nate knows that better than anyone. The care home is calm, serene even, with a soft color palette and natural light flooding in through large windows. The manager, Greta Williams, a bird-like woman drowning in a chunky cardigan, leads me to a back garden, where my mother is seated in a cushioned chair. She is facing a wild rosebush, the fragrance wafting toward me as I approach. Fat bumblebees flit between the pink blossoms, and my mom watches them, rapt. When I look at her face, I see a small, contented smile. This is why I stayed with Benjamin, why I signed his contract and followed his rules. My mother is at peace here, maybe even happy. Despite all she has lost, her memories, her identity, her daughter. She is comfortable and cared for. I pull up a chair and sit next to her. Was she always this tiny? She was petite but strong. I felt it when she held me in her arms, comforted me and supported me. Now she is softer, her body fragile and brittle, wasting away. "Hi, Mama," I whisper, and she turns her face toward me. It is there for only a second, a flicker of recognition. She knows me, I am sure of it. And then her eyes go blank again, and she turns back to the view. I take her hand, soft and papery, and talk softly to her about our memories, the good ones only. The hard times, the mistakes, our financial struggles are all forgotten and forgiven. All I remember are the laughs, the cuddles, the unconditional love a parent has for a child. The only pure love I have ever felt. I gloss over my marriage and my affair and tell her that she raised a strong and vital woman, that I have taken control of my own destiny, that I am not a victim anymore. She doesn't notice the faint remnant of bruising under my eye, mostly camouflaged by makeup now, or the swelling on the right side of my lip from Benjamin's slap. I kiss her on the cheek, and then I say goodbye. When I get home, Benjamin is ensconced in his study. He doesn't emerge, doesn't ask after my mother's welfare, doesn't check to see if I'm upset. It would be out of character, frankly, disconcerting, if he did. I can just hear his voice, serious and professional, through the closed door. I know better than to interrupt, and I feel no need to say goodbye to him. I turn to Nate. "I'm going to take a bath." He nods, gives me a small smile of compassion. Nate has a mother. He understands what I'm going through. He is human, unlike Benjamin. I climb the stairs slowly, my body weary, resigned. But my spirit feels light, because I am ready. Ready to let go, and ready to make my husband pay. Inside the luxurious bathroom, I lock the door behind me and turn on the bathtub tap's full blast. The hot water gives the air a steamy jungle feel, and the sound of the rushing water will camouflage my voice. I won't leave a suicide note. Benjamin will feel nothing when he reads it, except maybe relief. No guilt or shame or regret. And he will destroy it instantly. Tell his friends and colleagues that I was depressed, unhinged, ill. Public humiliation is the only way I can hurt him. Propping my iPhone on the quartz countertop, I hit record. Leaning close to the camera, I begin to speak. "My name is Hazel Laval," I say. My voice just above a whisper, shaky with nerves and emotion. And I'm about to kill myself. Over the past few days, I had come to accept that suicide was my only option. With my husband home and security on high alert, there was no other way to set myself free and protect my mother. But before I died, I would destroy Benjamin. I still had the power of my voice. A recorded suicide note, indicting my husband for his abuse and shared online, would ruin him. He'd be fired from his job, shunned from his social circle, maybe even held criminally responsible for my death. My husband, Benjamin Laval, is cruel and abusive, I continue. He's treated me like a slave for years. He made me sign a total power exchange contract, giving him complete control over my life. He locked me in a room when I disobeyed him, and he mentally, physically, and emotionally tortured me. I can't, no, I won't take it anymore. But there is no other way out. By the time you see this message, I'll be dead. Benjamin Laval killed me.
I hope he will pay for it. Somehow. When I am done recording, I open a scheduling app. In 1 week, my video will post to all my social media channels. I had never been very active online, but I'd curated a sparse but perfect feed. Photos of meals I'd cooked, ocean views, a selfie in a gorgeous outfit. But this video will blow away the facade. And, God willing, it will blow up my husband's life. After I turn off the taps, I reach under the sink and remove a bottle of lemon-scented cleaning solution. A few days ago, I'd emptied it, washed it, and filled it with vodka. If Benjamin found a bottle of liquor concealed in the bathroom, he'd have been suspicious, and I would have been sent to the basement room. At the back of the drawer in my vanity rests a bottle of sleeping pills. My husband never allowed me to have more than 12 pills at a time, but I've been stockpiling them. I've got 28 tablets now, more than enough, combined with the vodka. I will fall asleep, slip under the water, and I won't come up. By the time Benjamin or Nate becomes concerned and picks the lock or breaks down the door, it will be too late. I'll be dead. My hands fumble with buttons and zippers as I slowly, methodically, remove my clothes. I already know what it feels like to drown. The intense pressure in the lungs, the moment of panic as the body instinctively fights to breathe, followed by a deep, heavy rest. The cold softened the experience for me the last time. This time, the substances will do it. And Lee won't be there to wrench me from the water. Shaking the pills into my hand, I notice that I am trembling. I am ready. This is the best, the only way. But now I'm frightened. I am a young woman, and I'm about to die. Despite my circumstances, there is a flicker of life force inside me that doesn't want to be extinguished. I take a large drink of vodka, liquid courage. It is in that moment that I hear the front doorbell ring. I should not be diverted from my plan. Who knows when I will have another opportunity? I should swallow these pills, wash them down with more vodka, and climb into the tub. But Nate's muffled voice travels through the floorboards, followed by the voice of a woman. My curiosity has piqued. Unannounced guests are rare at our house, female ones even more so. Could it be Lee? Come to confront me for double-crossing her, or to thank me for saving her? Dumping the medication back into its bottle, I grab a floral silk robe off the hook on the back of the door and slip into it. Tentatively, I move into the hallway. The voices are clearer now. I hear the woman again and perhaps an unknown man. Benjamin has joined them too. His anger and belligerence travel up the staircase. "This is a fucking outrage," he bellows, and the female voice responds inaudibly. If it's Lee at the door, I must protect her. She is no match for an angry Benjamin. Wrapping my thin robe tighter around me, I hurry down the stairs in bare feet. As I scurry toward the entryway, it becomes clear that the female interloper is not Lee. Her voice is calm, authoritarian, and her words are just audible. She is reading the Miranda rights. But to whom? I burst into the foyer. What the hell is going on? But it is obvious. My husband is being arrested. A muscular, uniformed officer is cuffing Benjamin's hands behind his back, like he is a common criminal, like he is a threat to society. My chest flutters with a combination of shock, elation, and hope. The woman, a detective, I assume, given her no-nonsense blazer and slacks ensemble, approaches me. "Are you Hazel Laval?"
"Yes."
"My name is Detective French. We're arresting your husband for conspiracy to commit murder."
"Murder?"
I feel chilled and exposed in my thin silk robe, my teeth chattering through my words.
Whose murder?
Her face is grave, her lips pressed into a thin line. Yours, she says. 50. I stagger back as if shoved. French reaches out, cups my elbow for support, but I don't collapse. Somehow, I remain upright, though my mind is reeling with the news and the logistics of it. Had Benjamin and I been simultaneously plotting each other's deaths? Or had he found out about Jesse's and my plan to get rid of him and decided I needed to die? I almost saved him the trouble. If the police had arrived an hour later, I'd have been dead. The detective's hand is steady on my arm. Would you like to sit down? I nod, let her lead me to the living room where I sink into the sofa. Behind me, I hear Benjamin instructing Nate.
Call David Vega. Get him to meet me at the station.
And then he addresses the cops.
We'll have this dismissed at arraignment, and you'll have egg on your face.
I turn in my seat to watch the uniformed officer escorting my husband out the door. The whole scenario feels unbelievable, dreamlike. Moments ago, I had only one way out of my abusive marriage, and now my husband is being taken to jail. Something bubbles up inside me. Optimism. Because if Benjamin is behind bars, he can no longer hurt me. I'll be safe. And I'll be free. As if he can read my mind, Benjamin calls back to me.
Don't worry, Missy. I'll be home soon.
Despite his pleasant tone, it is a warning, a threat. A visible shiver runs through me. French clocks it.
Don't worry. He won't be.
Are you sure? My voice is husky. Is he going to jail?
He'll be processed and sent to holding, she says. He'll likely be arraigned tomorrow. Given the seriousness of these charges and his extensive resources, I'll be surprised if he gets bail.
You don't know him, I tell her. He's powerful and connected. He's a criminal defense lawyer. My panic is building. Benjamin was planning to kill me. If he gets out, he will finish the job. I feel lightheaded, weak, sick. The detective attempts to calm me.
You'll be assigned a victim's advocate to guide you through the legal process, she says. You'll be kept informed of his release, if it happens.
If. It's not good enough.
You might want to consider getting your own lawyer, French says, her voice low and confidential. This could get messy.
There's no doubt about that.
And I have no one else to lean on. No friends, no family. Benjamin has made sure of it. I can hardly reach out to my circle of acquaintances, the spouses of my husband's colleagues. You may have heard Benjamin has been arrested for planning to murder me. Would you like to try that new wine bar on Pike?
Most people can't afford it, the cop adds,
glancing around at our luxurious surroundings.
But it can make things a lot easier.
She thinks I am rich, for obvious reasons. But despite my fine home filled with expensive art and furnishings, I don't have my own money. Benjamin gave me credit cards that I was allowed to use for clothes, groceries, and beauty treatments. I asked him for cash when I needed it, but he wouldn't necessarily oblige me. And the safe in his study is practically emptied of money. I had found the code, written on a slip of paper tucked behind a picture frame. The money was now with Lee, who was hopefully in Panama. I'll do it, I tell her, because I have to protect myself. Can you recommend someone?
I'll see that you get a list of lawyers who handle these kinds of cases.
Thanks. She stands, suddenly cool and perfunctory.
We have a warrant to seize the computers and smartphones as evidence. Can you show me where they are?
Of course. I get up and lead her toward the study, but Nate blocks our path.
Can I see the warrant?
He says. He is loyal to Benjamin. He is still on the payroll. Despite our affinity, Nate is not my ally. For all I know, he could have been tasked with my murder. But he'd had ample opportunity to do it, and he hadn't. So how had my husband planned to get rid of me? The officer hands Nate a document, and he looks it over. Apparently, it's all in order because he steps aside. Detective French summons two uniformed officers with a wave of her hand, and I lead them into Benjamin's sanctuary. The laptop is there on the desk, hooked up to a massive monitor. The police must have confiscated my husband's phone when they arrested him because I don't see it. Did he have any other devices? French asks me. An iPad, an extra phone? No, not that I know of. We'll need your phone, too. But why? I'm the victim here. There might be texts or emails between you and your husband that we can use as evidence in our case against him. My husband's correspondence with me was only ever instructions. What he wanted for dinner, what clothes I should wear, where I was to meet him for an event. I'm almost sure there is nothing to incriminate me on my phone. I never texted Jesse. We were careful about that. The police will only find trivial chit-chat with my superficial friends. And Lee, our conversations were so much deeper. But over text, they were logistical only. I remember the flurry of calls the day she went to the spa, but they are easily explained. A friend with car trouble. A friend who has moved on. And then I remember the suicide video. My phone is upstairs, I say as panic flips my stomach over. I was about to take a bath. Officer Dean will take you upstairs, French says, waving over a strapping young man in uniform. I promise we'll get your phone back to you as soon as possible. Why do I need an escort? Again, I feel like she suspects me of something, like she knows there is more to this story. But perhaps she just thinks I am too weak to make it up the stairs. I give the young officer a complacent smile and allow him to trail me to the upper level. As we approach the bathroom, I turn to Officer Dean. I'm going to be sick, I tell him, and I know it's convincing. I am pale and clammy. I clutch my stomach for effort. Can I have a moment? He nods. To him, I'm a woman who has just learned that her husband wants her dead. Nothing more. I hurry into the bathroom and lock the door. Inside, I turn on the sink to camouflage my movements. My phone is on the edge of the tub and I grab it, quickly canceling the scheduled video. Then I delete the recording and the app. I have already ensured my files don't sync to the cloud. The police don't need to know that I ever thought about killing myself. No one does. Because now I want to live. If Benjamin goes to jail, I will be a free woman. I can be happy. I can have my life back. Putting the vodka-filled bottle of cleaner back under the sink, I shove the sleeping pills into the drawer and turn off the taps. I look at myself in the mirror, wan and shaky, but safe. For the moment, at least. I must remain calm. I must protect my secrets. With my phone in hand, I exit the bathroom. Officer Dean is leaning casually against the opposite wall when I emerge, but he rights himself quickly. Here it is, I say, handing the phone to him. I notice the plastic gloves he is wearing, the plastic bag he drops it into. It's all so official, and I feel vulnerable again.
You can get dressed, he says, and we'll take you down to the station.
Why do I need to go to the station?
Your perspective is important. It's standard procedure.
But I have nothing to say. I had no idea my husband was planning to kill me. The words sound like a foreign language in my ears.
It's our job to build a case for the prosecutor. If we don't do it thoroughly, your husband could get off.
Fear sends a tremor through me, rattles my bones. If Benjamin gets released after this, he will be lethal. The officer sees my angst and presses on.
As the intended victim, you might know something useful.
The intended victim. But I have so much to hide. Of course, I say. But can't we just talk here? I'm really not feeling well.
Detective French would like you to come to the station.
I could crack under a harsh interrogation, spill all my secrets, my own deadly plans. But if I refuse to go, it will look bad. I will look guilty. And so, I give him an obliging nod. Give me a few minutes.